This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. We are about to embark on a big fight for who replaces Justice Kennedy on the Supreme Court. But are we relying too much on the Supreme Court to solve these thorny issues like travel bans and reproductive rights and who gets to buy cake? Glenn Weil, who we've talked to before, actually pretty recently, is part of the Microsoft think tank and has been developing voting systems which might make it possible to solve these issues in a way that the current Congress cannot. So, Glenn, you proposed this for these tough Supreme Court issues. Lead us gently through how we'd be able to decide these issues without a Supreme Court.
Well, you know, I think that the main question is, can we have a democratic system that protects minorities? Because we rely so much on the Supreme Court precisely because we don't feel it's legitimate to just allow minorities to be run all over by the majorities in countries. The problem is that we don't have a voting system that allows minorities to protect themselves. And that's exactly what we're trying to create.
Okay, so for an issue like abortion, which is bound to come up, how would you decide that without a Supreme Court?
So the idea is that every citizen would receive some what we call voice credits in equal measure.
Voice credits.
Yes, exactly. These would be a currency, but not for buying food or cars, but for making collective decisions. And everyone would get an equal number of these. But rather than everyone getting one vote on every issue or in each election, like we do in the usual democratic process, citizens would have a choice of where they want to use these voice credits so that they could put them on the issues that are most important to their future, to their family, et cetera.
So you'd have these voice credits, everybody would get the same number, and then you'd have some kind of ballot sheet where you could decide how many voice credits to plunk down on the issues that you care most about.
Yeah, and in fact, the rule is a little bit sophisticated because you don't just want extremists to put all of their votes on one issue.
Right.
So it actually, in our rule, becomes increasingly costly to get an additional vote on an issue as you have more votes on it. And it's actually followed something called the quadratic rule, which isn't really necessary to understand. But for that reason, it would work best if you have a bit of software, which is what we've used to put it into practice. And people actually find it quite intuitive to navigate once you have the visual aids that that allows.
So if you put all your votes on the abortion issue, you will not have any votes left for anything else.
Let me give you an example. Imagine you have 100 credits and there are 10 issues. You could get 10 votes on the abortion issue. But if you instead spread out your credits over different things on the side that you feel, you would get 30 votes. So if you concentrate everything, you get a lot fewer votes than if you have a more broad perspective.
So you take the number of votes on one issue and you square that, and that's what you have to deduct from your balance.
Exactly.
I see. Well, that's not too tough to understand, but I think it would just strike people as being too weird to be taken seriously. Has this actually been tried anywhere?
We used it on a poll for about 6,000 participants of all different education levels nationwide, and it was pretty interesting because people completed it at the same rate as they complete normal surveys, but they spent a lot longer doing it. And we got a lot of very interesting and perhaps revealing results, like men who are progressive when they don't have to pay any cost for it usually say that they're strongly in favor of women's pay equality. But once you make them pay the cost, progressive women keep saying that, but progressive men spend their credits elsewhere.
I see. You've likened this to the way small towns make decisions. And how does that work?
Well, not all small towns do it exactly in this way. But if you think about, you know, don't even think about towns. Just think about the way in which you make decisions with friends about what restaurant to go to.
Mm-hmm.
You don't just take a vote. You try to get a sense, is that person allergic to sushi, you know, et cetera, et cetera. You try to make a decision that will be best for everyone. And if someone really insists on something, there's an expectation that later on they'll pay you back in some way. And this is trying to replicate this by having it be cheap for people to push things a little bit in one direction or the other and pretty expensive for them to make a big impact, but to allow them to do that so that it's not just the majority rules and the other guy has to be sick through the whole meal.
Yeah. Is it your sense that the Supreme Court has outlived its usefulness?
Look, we're never going to have a country without a Supreme Court or judges or anything like that. But I think it's crazy for us to have a country where for 40 years, you know, from the 30s till the 70s or the 80s, you had all these huge social changes being implemented by the Supreme Court. And now it looks like we're getting a huge swing back in the other direction. And in fact, before the 30s and the 70s, there were 40 years when you had the court imposing segregation and stopping Roosevelt from regulating the economy and creating Social Security and so forth. So these crazy swings where we have the most contentious social issues being determined by unelected officials, that's not a way to run a democracy.
Would you have to have at least a minimum participation level in these nationwide opinion polls for them to count? Because I can see where a few people who fancy themselves enlightened and who understand the quadratic voting system could take it over.
Well, certainly we wouldn't want to implement the system without extensive experimentation, which is exactly what's going on right now. I mentioned the polling that I told you about, but also all sorts of blockchain communities are implementing this. We just had to tabulate this, and there's been, just since the book came out, about 16 projects working on implementing this and related ideas. You know, we want them to be used for online polling of all sorts, or for rating, you know, for example, Uber drivers or products. So that, you know, is the path, I think, to eventually making this nationwide.
By the way, how often would you pass go and get a new bag of voice credits to be able to vote? Because I can see where today's controversial issue, which might merit 10 of your voice votes, might be completely eclipsed just a few months later by another contentious issue.
I think my idea would be that every year everyone would get an income of this, which would be maybe something like equal to 10% of the total credits that are out there. So every 10 years, they'd effectively be renewed. And in fact, you could even apply that to young people. So they could start accruing credits as soon as they're born, but then they might not use them until later. And so they'd start life with a little bank of voice credits.
Wow. An intriguing principle. Glenn Weil is principal researcher for Microsoft's think tank. He's also the author of Radical Markets, Uprooting Capitalism and Democracy for a Just Society. Thanks, Glenn.
Always a pleasure to talk to you, Dave.
This is Seattle's Morning News. We were told after the summit with Kim Jong-un that North Korea was on a path to denuclearization and we could all sleep well. And then last week we were talking with CBS's military analyst Mike Lyons, and he said, well, by the way, Dave, did you know that there are satellite photos showing that North Korea is working on a new nuclear facility, which didn't sound like it was in the spirit of the summit conference. So let's talk to Daryl Kimball. He is the director of the Arms Control Association. Daryl, what information do we have on this?
Well, there is a credible independent report based upon satellite photography that the North Koreans are making some improvements to their existing Yongbyon nuclear facility, where they have for some 20 years operated a small reactor that produces plutonium that can be used for nuclear weapons. So I'm not surprised that the North Koreans continue to improve this site. We have to remember that so far in this process, the North Koreans have only agreed to halt ballistic missile tests and nuclear test explosions. They have not yet agreed to stop the production of plutonium and highly enriched uranium, which can be used for nuclear weapons. So the next challenge for the Trump administration and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is to solidify and expand the freeze of North Korea's nuclear program so that while the talks about denuclearization continue, North Korea cannot improve its nuclear weapons capabilities.
So is running this reactor considered an improvement of their capabilities?
Well, it could be, but the main point here is that the reactor continues to operate. That means that it continues to produce fresh nuclear fuel, which then can be removed and the plutonium can be extracted from that fuel. So what we need to do, what the Trump administration needs to make a priority, is to persuade North Korea to shut down this reactor and to shut down any other facilities that might be producing plutonium or highly enriched uranium. And, you know, until that happens, it is quite possible for the North Koreans to amass more nuclear bomb-grade material that can be used to expand its arsenal, which is now somewhere between 10 and about 50 nuclear devices.
50 nuclear devices?
Well, 10 to 50. Again, because we don't have a lot of insight into the North Korean program or as much as we'd like, the estimates about how many nuclear devices they have actually built varies. The lowest estimates are around 10, the highest around 50.
Well, what is the limiting factor here, the difficulty in assembling them or just the availability of the fuel for them?
Well, the key ingredient that you need to make nuclear weapons is plutonium or highly enriched uranium. And it's clear the North Koreans already have the knowledge to build a nuclear device, and because they've conducted six nuclear test explosions. So a key factor in limiting their ability to expand their arsenal is to stop the production of more bomb-grade material. So that's the first step. And the next step in the denuclearization process, in my view, will be to get a good map of what the North Korean program looks like, to get the North Koreans to provide what's called a declaration of their infrastructure, their sites, the history of producing bomb-grade material, so that we can then make a plan with them for the shutdown of these sites with international monitoring to verify that they've actually done it. So we're just at the beginning of this process, and you know, unfortunately, President Trump has oversold the outcomes of the Singapore summit. You know, the reality is that it's a good start, it's a positive start, but now we need to move on to the next steps in this years-long and very difficult process.
Yeah. Well, I kind of assume it was oversold, but that's why we're talking to you. So, How do you define denuclearization? Would it include the complete disassembly of this plant, even if it is used occasionally to produce electricity, or would they be allowed to keep certain nuclear plants?
Well, that's a great question that, frankly, the two sides are going to have to negotiate. I mean, when I think about denuclearization, and as the international community thinks about denuclearization, it means that the North Koreans must first verifiably halt further nuclear weapons production and testing. Then we need to have them dismantle and disable the facilities used to produce material like this reactor, the facilities that are used to assemble the nuclear devices, the facilities that are engaged in design work for nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles. And then the tough part will be eventually securing and perhaps removing from North Korea the physical nuclear material that can be used to make nuclear bombs, and then finally the actual weapons. And those will probably have to be, if we get this far, disassembled in North Korea by teams of U.S., maybe Chinese, maybe also Russian experts working in cooperation with the North Korean scientists who help design and build these devices.
Wow.
So it's going to be a complex process. But I think the thing to keep in mind is that, you know, how do we judge progress here? In our view, the further we can get towards the ultimate goal of denuclearization, the better. The more constrained and limited North Korea's nuclear capabilities will be, and the further away from threats of fire and fury and the possibility of war in the peninsula we will be. So we may not get to the ultimate goal of denuclearization of the peninsula, but the faster and further we get, the better.
And how do we know that deep underground, in a place that the satellites can't look, there isn't some sort of secret facility that we don't know about?
Well, this will always be a risk. You know, it is impossible to have 100% certainty when it comes to this kind of disarmament in a country that is so secretive, that does have many tunnels, quite literally speaking. So, you know, I think we may have to live with that kind of uncertainty into the future. If If they have, you know, two bombs in a basement, however, I think that's certainly better than having 200 loaded on ballistic missiles, some of which might be able to hit the United States. So we need to consider what the alternatives are, and we need to remember that simply moving in the right direction and getting close to total disarmament is far better than the alternative.
Can't quarrel with that. Daryl Kimball is Executive Director of the Arms Control Association. Thank you, Daryl. I appreciate it.
Thank you much.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Do you need to get your genes tested? Let's call in the doctor.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, there are all sorts of gene testing companies out there which purport to tell you where you came from, but can also tell you what little hidden secrets might be lurking in your genes. So you've investigated this. First of all, is this something that will become a standard procedure in the future? Do these tests give information to you as a doctor that you would like to have about your patients?
Yeah, good morning, Dave. This is a really interesting topic, and it's something that I'm sure a question a lot of people are asking themselves because, as we all know, we've been inundated on television and even radio and print ads with advertisements from companies selling their genetic testing that you can do at home. So it turns out that in the human genome, we're not exactly sure yet. It was originally thought that there were hundreds of thousands of genes, but we now know there's somewhere between 19,000 and 20,000 different genes. And these genes are what encode all the different processes that make up our body. We can't change our genes. They are what they are. If you have genes for blue eyes, you have blue eyes. Now, with all this at-home genetic testing, it serves to sort of unlock who we are and what's inside. There was a company, 23andMe, that probably most people have heard of that came out in the early, around 2010, 2011, and they started doing genetic testing for people at home, and they really made it very easily available. Well, normally, if you would go to your physician and you would get genetic testing, they would do it for a very specific medical condition, and it would go through your insurance, and it would be something that was very expensive. So here, they were making information available to the general population for less than $100. So now this has become a widespread in the marketplace, and all these companies are popping up trying to find their own little niche within the market. So what is it that we can get from these different tests? So given the widespread availability of these at-home genetic tests, what are the benefits? So the benefits are, first of all, that it's direct to the consumer genetic testing, and so it can help you be more aware of genetic diseases that you otherwise may not think about. Next, it provides personalized information about your health, potentially for disease risk, although that's been regulated somewhat by the FDA, and disease carrier traits. When you have this information, it may actually help you to be more proactive about your health. Oftentimes, if you know you're at risk or you have a predisposition for something, you'll actually be more inclined to do something about it. It's also nice that it doesn't require approval from a healthcare provider or a health insurance company. They're relatively inexpensive, so you can do it at home, whereas genetic testing obtained through a healthcare provider is really usually quite expensive.
Well, so are physicians then trained to, I mean, if I walked into my personal physician and said, hey, I had this test done, take a look at it, doc, are doctors trained to draw conclusions based on that?
Yeah, that's another great question, Dave. They're not. And that's the thing, is that the genetic companies are picking out a small number of genes. Like I just said, there's 19,000 to 20,000 different genes in the human genome. And so they're pulling out, you know, maybe a couple hundred at most and testing you. And doctors, even if you compare from test to test between at-home genetic tests, you're not necessarily getting the same genes tested. So doctors are not really trained to have someone walk in with their results from an at-home genetic test and be able to tell you what it means in your particular setting. One of the benefits of having this test is that it may help you be more proactive about your health because it does provide you with this personalized information about disease risk. So, yes, as a physician, I would always counsel patients, do not smoke. It's just not good for you. Don't smoke. And there's so many bad things associated with it. However, somebody who is a smoker and is actually concerned about their health, they may be a little bit more motivated to stop smoking if they understand and that their risk for developing lung cancer is increased.
See, I thought for a moment you were dismissing the value of this, but it sounds like you're saying eventually everybody will have a gene test, and you as the physician will say, "And here's the diet that would be ideal for you. These are the bad habits to look out for. and this is how long you have to live? I mean, you know, how far would it go?
Oh no, I think the value of genetic testing is incredibly high. I think it's of tremendous value, and I would recommend it. I think we just have to sort out where the genetic testing comes from, whether it's physician guided genetic testing or if it's just at home genetic testing. And I think they're really not the same thing, and nor are they really intended to be the same thing, which is why the FDA got involved. The at home genetic testing is a shotgun approach. It's not really focused on disease states. It's focused on other things that are more novelty, like your ancestry. Whereas physician-guided genetic testing is incredibly useful because if you sit down with somebody and you want to find out how best to lose weight, how best to optimize your exercise program, how best to even manage lifestyle choices, if you do the appropriate genetic testing, you can understand where your strengths and weaknesses are and then use that information to create a very, very personalized program. But that usually happens under the guidance of a physician and other medical experts rather than, you know, an at-home test that you buy with just a battery of random tests.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Thank you, Dr. Cohen.
Thanks, Dave.
It's time for our Sports Insider from 710 ESPN Seattle, brought to you by Western Washington Toyota Dealers. You can hear Danny O'Neill weekdays at 3 on Danny, Dave, and more. And Heather Bosch with us to join us.
Good morning.
For this segment today. What can you say? The Mariners are hot, Danny.
Colleen, Dave's not here.
I know.
You know what your job is.
You got to do it.
Get out the dustpan and push broom, Grandma. It's sweep time. Woo!
Is that good? That was very good.
Nice.
That was good.
That was hard to go.
Nicely done.
I don't know how Dave does it.
Yeah, and he kind of like crows it, sweep time.
Yeah. Ever the performer. I cannot live up to that.
No, it was great.
What can you say? They're doing awesome.
It was awesome. And turn ahead the clock night. Did you see it on Saturday?
Yeah, well, what I saw it, and then what I saw more of is people griping about how they looked.
Griping?
Yes.
Who was griping?
I loved it.
It was fantastic.
Maybe my Twitter algorithm just aired towards the crotchety guys who were like, tuck in your shirt. Why is your hat backwards, D? You know, it was...
Well, A,
grow up.
The umpire did ask D to tuck in his shirt when he got to the plate.
Sure.
Which I was like, D should just turn to him like, in the future, bro, we don't tuck in.
In the future, you don't exist either, Mr. Umpire Man.
That's exactly right.
It's a machine.
That's great, Chris. They should have done that.
About to be replaced by AI.
I thought they looked awesome, though. I loved them.
It was a blast. Yeah. And Nelson Cruz, massive arms.
Yeah, we got tickets to the gun show.
24-inch pythons.
Yes.
There's no doubt about it. My favorite was Ben Gamble, though.
With the hair.
With the 1987 Klamath Falls gas station attendant look.
Yeah.
The only thing that was missing was a red handkerchief in his back pocket so he could wipe off the gas tank after. He looked fantastic. In fact, I'm thinking of dressing up as Ben on Friday.
Yeah, did they offer those uniforms to buy? Can you do that?
Well, I hope that... I know you can buy the hats. Okay. Not sure I'm working on the... It was a blast. And they did. They won. They absolutely muzzled the Kansas City Bats over the course of the weekend. You had one run by Marco Gonzalez on Friday. They gave up four on that Saturday game. And then a 1-0 shutout yesterday by James Paxton. And look out. The Mariners are one half game back of the Houston Astros for first place in the best division in baseball.
Can they keep this up, though?
Yeah, I think
they
can.
Do you think they got the momentum? No injuries that'll mess us up?
At this point, I mean, they've made it without Robinson Cano for 40 games.
True.
With injuries to their bullpen, their bullpen's going to get healthier. Their starting pitching, it's not like anybody you would look at and say he's just not capable of sustaining what he's done. Yeah, I do think that they can keep it up because I think Kyle Seager's going to hit better in the second half than he did in the first half, and he's one of their main cogs. I absolutely love. The other thing is they don't have to give back any of these games. Their record in one-run games, which is like 26-11 now, they don't have to give back any of those. They've been great in close games. And if they're 500 the rest of the way, I think they make the playoffs. And I think they're going to be better than 500 the rest of the way.
I do want to point out that the James Paxton bobblehead doll has an eagle on his shoulder.
Yeah.
We're going to stand together, shoulder to shoulder, to fight for your protection.
I don't know what that happened. Well, that Kremlin's was random. Let's go to Cam Chancellor, because I want to make sure, as much as I want to bask in the glory of the Mariners right now, we have to talk about Cam Chancellor. He issued that tweet yesterday talking about, it sounds like he's done playing.
It does sound like that. He didn't use the word retirement, but I think that's mostly contractual semantics, that he is simply physically not cleared to play. The tests that he's undergone have shown no healing. I think it was always considered unlikely. You're the Instagram lurker,
well,
right?
That's the thing, is that he hasn't been posting much lately. He's posted a few with his wife.
There was a couple weeks ago he posted one. He looked skinny.
Really?
Like when I saw the picture, I looked at him and I was like, that's not a guy getting ready for an NFL season.
Well,
he looks great.
And we won't
and
see
he's
him
cut
on the
and
field.
He's shredded, but he's 200 pounds is about what it looked like in the picture. Picture that I'd seen.
Is this the one you're talking about?
No, there's one without his shirt on where you can see each ripple of his ab muscles.
This one.
Yes, that's the one. Yeah. I don't even think that's a six pack. That looks
Sorry
like
you guys
he's
can't
exposed
see this, but you're right. He does look thin. Bottom line, though, we won't see him again, but contractually he'll still probably, wear a jersey?
No, he still gets two years of full salary. This year and next year most likely are entirely guaranteed. Certainly this year is.
Okay.
So it's mostly just for payroll purposes. He's still going to count against the salary cap, and he's still going to get his salary, but I don't expect to see him play at all, and certainly the post he said yesterday made it pretty clear that you won't.
Anybody up and coming that can compare to him? Because, boy, was he fun to watch.
No, he's one of a kind. Yeah. And I think more than anybody, he embodied the Seahawks, both their rise and winning of the Super Bowl. He was the guy that I voted for Super Bowl MVP when they won in the balloting at that game. And in some ways, their struggle with success when he held out and kind of that everybody looking to share the spoils of the victories that they'd had and kind of threw it off. And then he came back to the team, and maybe there's a sense that it's kind of fitting that he's stepping away in this offseason when the team and the defense specifically is undergoing the biggest changes that we've seen in 5 or 6 years.
Boy, I wish we had more time to talk because I want to get to LeBron James, but can we talk about him tomorrow?
LeBron going to the Lakers. Not a surprise. Not a surprise.
That's a good summary. Thank you, Danny.
You bet.
Your Sports
Talk to you soon.
Insider brought to you by Western Washington Toyota Dealers.
Let's go.
Time for Choke Points. It's a bonus Monday edition of Choke Points, actually. It's brought to you by Online Trading Academy. And we're going to talk about tolling, specifically the possibility of tolling I-5. And who better to answer that than Sully? What's going on? I heard you talking about this on your way in this morning.
Yeah, I was working with a representative, Mark Harmsworth, who works up in that area on Friday, and it's becoming clear that congestion pricing is gaining popularity as a way to fund our roads and to manage the horrible traffic. And with that, the idea of creating general purpose lanes appears to be going away. Because, I mean, let's think about it. We've got tolls on 405. We've got them on 520. We've got them on 16. We've got them on 167. Is I-5 far behind?
Well, we've talked about this before, and it's always sort of a wild, far-off idea. Is it closer now?
Well, the Puget Sound Regional Council, which represents this region, is exploring the idea of tolling I-5 between Everett and Marysville.
Oh, no.
The plan, as it stands right now, is to add a lane in both directions along that stretch. So add a lane of freeway, both north and southbound, between Everett and Marysville, but make it a hot lane.
Tolling all lanes.
No,
just
but making the HOV lane a buy-in lane there. So either way, it's
but
a toll.
It ends.
Well, right, they're north of right, but they would extend that HOV lane from where it ends there by Marine View Drive all the way up into Marysville.
Well, that'd be helpful because
potentially
it crunches
beyond
that area,
right,
and backs it
up. But if you're a solo driver who's used to, you know, would like some capacity, you'd have to buy your way in.
Hmm.
So HOV drivers would use it for free. Solo drivers to pay. The price would vary based on congestion, just like it does on 167. State Rep Mark Harmsworth, as I mentioned, represents that region. He talked to Dory Monson on Friday. He believes the plan is to eventually toll every road in the region.
It's not funded now, but they're starting to put it out there because they want us to get used to it. They want to bring that boiling water up because we're the frogs in the boiling water. And they want us to get used to this concept of just fundamentally paying for our roads through tolls rather than through other means.
The state is already toying with the idea of tolling the Highway 2 trestle as a way to pay for an expansion there. Harmsworth says his constituents in the Lake Stevens, Snohomish area can't afford it. And adding a toll to I-5 would price many people out.
And DOT's whole premise here is to make it so horrible to drive on a regular purpose lane that you just give up. They're literally pricing us out of our cars to put us into transit, which is where they ultimately want us all.
Now, the Puget Sound Regional Council calls for construction on this to begin in 2035. So we've got some time. I mean, it's not like this is happening tomorrow, but this shows you that they are already planning for this with that new hot lane to open in 2040.
It shows me nothing, because something they're talking about today that's going to open in 2035 in no way helps anyone.
No, but it gets you to, it buoys the idea that people believe that it has long been the idea. I mean, tolling 405 10 years ago, people would have thought you were crazy. Yet we have it today.
Did we need it 10 years ago?
We probably could have. We needed the capacity, which is what they promised us on 405. Now, the legislature, of course, would have to sign off on this plan, and so would the federal government, of course, because I-5 is a federal facility. D.C. would have to chime in on this thing. And what's interesting in this overall discussion of where tolls are going, this is happening in Portland as well. In fact, that region's looking at tolling I-5 and I-205 to manage its congestion there to get around between Clark County and Washington down across Portland and whatnot. And a regional group just approved moving forward with tolling I-5 in Portland, and it's ready to have its proposal ready for the feds by the end of this year. Portland calls it value pricing.
What?
We call it congestion pricing. They call it value pricing.
Some consultant told them, make it sound happier.
Yeah. So even though I know this 2035, 2040 timeframe is a lot, but the fact that they're actually looking and I mean, it has to start. So this is actually on a drawing board. It's not someone just kind of saying this is, oh my God, this could happen. They're actually planning on this as a way we move forward with our transportation in the future.
You're going to keep an eye on this for us?
Yeah. What else do I do? I keep track of helping out our drivers out there.
Meantime, what could help us is that extra off-ramp into Marysville. When's that coming?
The construction on that, I think, is set to start pretty soon to build that new ramp on 529 that would get us finally for once an extra exit to Marysville, but put us on the east side of the railroad tracks so you wouldn't have to be beholden to a train and backing up the freeway. You'd have another option to get to the east side of Marysville. And in fact, just last week, the city itself started working on the 2nd Avenue bypass, which would take people off 1st Avenue, which takes them to the main Marysville exit. So there's a lot going on up in that area.
How do you think the Seattle Premium Outlets and the Tulalip Reservation feels about congestion pricing into their region?
Well, at this point, considering the sales up there, I'm sure they'd be happy with it, but last time I checked, I see more Canadian license plates up there than I do anywhere else. I think it's a lot of people coming the other direction. But either way, yeah, I don't know. We've got time to fight this or to talk about
it. 15-plus years. Thanks, Sully.
Hey, I look down the field. Always down the field.
Well, we got busy this weekend around the Pacific Northwest. Lots of rallies, protests, demonstrations going on, all about immigration laws and the separation of families. At the border, Hannah Scott, she toured some of those rallies this weekend, and she's here to tell us what happened.
Yeah, this was a big turnout nationwide. More than 700 Families Belong Together rallies were held across the country. Nearly 30 of those were here in our state, and I'm talking everywhere from Tacoma all the way up to Blaine. Now, while many of the rallies in our state drew hundreds, Cairo 7 says an estimated 10,000 people showed up for the rally outside the detention center in SeaTac. Among the top priority for demonstrators, immediately getting kids separated at the border back with their families.
They find themselves in a foreign country, a country whose language they don't speak, not knowing when, if ever, they'll see their parents again. Because the federal government has admitted that our immigration policies have left children orphaned.
But the speakers also took on the Trump administration's zero tolerance policy and the treatment of those seeking asylum, many of which a federal judge in California found last week were also being separated even when they showed up at ports of entry with legal documents.
This administration is violating the due process rights afforded to all by the Constitution. And if Donald Trump had his way, there would be no right to a hearing for immigrants seeking asylum.
In Everett, about 500 people gathered for a one-mile march through downtown and then gathered outside the Snohomish County Courthouse for a rally. Their message?
We are demanding immediate reunification of the families and an end to family detention. Period. No compromise. That's what we're demanding.
Several speakers took to the stage, including a local pastor who wasted no time speaking her mind.
Me and mine say to you clearly and loudly, Jeff Sessions does not speak for us.
Now, while the Trump administration recently shifted its policy to end the separation of families at the border, marchers say locking up entire families together is no better. And notions that the policy is about securing our borders didn't sit well with some of the folks I talked to.
We don't have open borders. That's the lie. They're not coming through willy-nilly. We have vetted people. We have to vet people. And, you know, if you want to come here, it's years in many cases to get vetted to get here. They have to go through like four different federal organizations, federal agencies to get here. So that's the lie that's covering up the racism and the white supremacy.
And she wasn't alone in that belief. Now, much like I've seen at some of the gun control marches, March for Our Lives events around the city that I've attended, there was a huge push to get people out and vote here and register to vote here. Some of the speakers got on stage and said, talking about our laws and our upcoming laws that will allow 16-year-olds to register to vote and early. They're really, really trying to get that out there, make a difference in these upcoming midterms. State Democratic Representative John Lovick, among several lawmakers who were at this particular rally in Everett.
We should do. I believe it's going to make a difference because I, just like I said, I think the power of the people is going to be greater than the people in power. We need to stand up, speak out. I'm not a person typically that gets out and march a whole lot. I've always been a peaceful person, but this is the time that I think we all need to use our voices.
And that was a response to a question I had asked him from several people, including this upcoming woman who said it was her first time getting out and rallying and marching. And
you're seeing that a lot recently.
A lot.
I'm a first-time protester.
And I'll tell you what he told me, Representative Lovick, that he thinks this issue and some of the other issues, there's a big feeling, at least from the people here that I spoke to over the weekend, that there's this feeling of hate that's this flourishing under this administration, and that if we want to make a difference in that, we need to hit the streets in numbers. Representative Lovick said that we've saw during the civil rights movement is what he encouraged.
Wow.
So this is a woman I spoke to who didn't come out very often, has a lot of concerns like the flourishing of hate and felt that the separation of children was the straw that broke the camel's back. But she didn't think that her being out there was really going to make a difference. This is some of what she's been experiencing.
You know, being African-American from the South, born and raised there. So it's real familiar. And I never thought in my lifetime that we would be here. You know, never, ever did I think I would be fearing for my life the way I do now as an African-American living in, you know, Everett, working in Everett and Marysville. I never thought I would be afraid to walk down the street, never knowing who's going to approach me and if they're going to harm me. I just never thought that hate would be a way of America again.
And yeah. She was disappointed. She's got a master's degree. She's a mental health professional. And she was telling me about the story about someone saying something very racist to her as she was walking to work in Marysville and just in shock. She is the first generation of her family not to work in some association on a plantation in the South. And she didn't think that she would ever see things like this again.
Yeah, it breaks my heart to know that instances of racism like this are coming out. You're hearing it more. You're seeing it more. There's almost this emboldened feeling to put people down, to shout racial slurs. And, you know, I personally want that to go away. There's no room for that. There's room for political discourse, but
sure.
There's not room for shouting down people with hate. In the country that I know, in the America that I want for my children. So
absolutely.
It's disheartening to hear that story from her.
I was pleased, at least at the rallies I went to, I didn't see that counter protesters yelling negative things or anything, at least not at the ones I attended. There may have been something like that around the country elsewhere. So we'll see where this goes. Again, I think this is going to be a big, big issue as we get to those November midterms.
Right. Well, thanks, Hannah, for being out there and covering the rallies.